for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Thoughtful writers have predicted the imminent demise of formal religion for years. But renowned Harvard Divinity School theologian Harvey Cox believes the soothsayers are wrong. He argues rather than disappearing, religion, and in particular Christianity, is now showing new vitality around the world, but with an essential shift in what it means to be religious. His new book is titled The Future of Faith. Harvey Cox joins me in the studio throughout the hour. We'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook, and you can send us a tweet. Good morning to you. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Diane.
You, I know, recently retired after 44 years at Harvard University, but you're still teaching.
Yeah, we have a sort of gradual retirement pattern there, so you go off easily without dropping, like, from a helicopter or something.
And the day of your retirement, you brought a cow into the courtyard.
This is true. There's an old tradition that the professor that holds the particular chair that I hold back to the early 1700s has the privilege of grazing his cow in Harvard Yard. As you can imagine, the last couple hundred years, no one seems to have taken advantage of that, but I thought, really, someone should. So I borrowed a cow from a friend of mine who has a farm in central Massachusetts. He brought her in, lovely brown-eyed Jersey cow, and we took her out into the yard. We, of course, notified the university security people before, and you can imagine quite a crowd of students was attracted. And I just said to them, look, we're reclaiming a very old and very valuable tradition. And maybe it shouldn't seem so illogical to see cows here. That's why it's called the yard, after all. They did have animals there. And there's no reason why we couldn't have animals, or at least maybe a garden. So I'm hoping something will happen out of that whole caper. It was fun.
And do you believe that there is a connection between the idea of religion, in particular Christianity, and the presence of that animal in the yard?
Oh, indeed I do. In fact, the whole point really underlying was we are, as Christians and as religious people more generally, responsible for the creation. And we're doing a terrible job in our responsibility as stewards for the creation. We're really mucking it up pretty badly. And we've also separated ourselves unduly from where our food comes from the animals. A lot of people don't even know that. So I think bringing these things back together is really part of a spiritual vocation. At least I'm committed to that. And I'm hoping that maybe the day will come when we will see cows again, or at least one or two, wandering around Harvard Yard and some vegetables. And it will remind us every day that we do have a responsibility for this little thing we call Earth.
In the book, you cite three epochs in how Christianity, for example, has changed over the past 2,000 years. You talk about the first three centuries as being the age of faith. You talk about the age of belief that came from the 4th to the 20th centuries. And then you talk about the age of spirit, a trend that you see began 50 years ago. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think that most people do not realize that for the first 300 years of Christian history, there were no hierarchies. There were no creeds. There wasn't any particularly united church. There were hundreds and hundreds of small congregations, extremely varied in their patterns and their theologies and their liturgies, and doing well. I mean, the Christianity was expanding in all different parts of the then known world. Then what happened in the early 300s was that Constantine, the emperor, decided he wanted Christianity to be, the imperial ideology, the state religion.
So to impose a kind of procedure and a kind of belief system.
Both a hierarchical structure and a belief system. He insisted on a single creed for everybody. We now call it the Nicene Creed. After his summer palace, by the way, where he brought all the bishops together and told them to write this creed, and they better well do it, because he at that point had all the money and power and got rid of the ones who wouldn't sign on. So Christianity was quite changed, I would say deformed, for the next centuries. Within 50 years after Constantine, the first Christian was killed by fellow Christians for lack of theological correctness. That had not happened before. So we went through a very long period in which propositional belief, giving assent to some creed or another, and they came and went, varied creeds contending with each other, was the mark of what it meant to be Christian, for at least for many people. Then in our own time, there's another quite remarkable transformation away from that period into a much more open, fluid, porous understanding of Christianity, especially as it is expanding rapidly outside of Europe and the United States. That's where the real growth is going on of Christianity, in what we used to call the Third World.
When you talk about what's going on in the Third World, what seems to be happening in this country is one angry hissy fit after another with one church, especially within, for example, my own denomination, the Episcopal Church, angry about women in the priesthood, angry about homosexuality in the priesthood. There seems to be nothing but hollering and division.
Well, yeah, I think you can get the impression that there's nothing but hollering and division. But, you know, if you go around to the local Episcopal parishes here and there, most people are really not enraged. They seem to be saying their prayers and singing and congregating around the coffee and so on, and engaged in some very important social action and social service things. A little church I attend occasionally, Episcopal Church, although I'm not an Episcopalian, does all these things, and they kind of ignore the noisy wings of the church. Now, there is some noise there, but think of all the noise there was when women were first made to priests.
Oh, I remember it well.
There's not much of that anymore as far as women are concerned. There are women bishops now, and people have adjusted to that rather well, and I think they will to gay clergy. It takes a while, and remember that the angry minority is always a minority, and it's always pretty noisy, but they'll get over it.
So you believe that, at least you say in the book, you see something like spirituality replacing religious belief.
Yes. Notice how many people you know, probably Diane and I do, who'll say to you, now, you know, I'm really not religious, but I am spiritual. So many people say that I had to ask myself, what do they mean?
Yeah.
And I think what they mean is they really long for some kind of access to mystery, to the sacred, to God, without going through all the institutional and doctrinal packaging in which it's been delivered to us. And I think that's an enormously important tendency, as well as the movement of people from one expression of Christianity to another, and among them in a way that they're looking for something, but they don't want to buy the whole package of anything. And I that's one of the qualities of spirituality. It's a trend that goes very, very far back. And for some people, it's a little wobbly. I mean, they say, spiritual, what does it mean? But I think it does have an important significance. And it has to do with the lowering of the institutional bite and certainly the doctrinal formulation into a more experiential and even kind of pragmatic way of being religious.
But at the same time, as one sees Protestantism and Protestant churches losing membership, at the same time, don't you see the evangelicals rising in membership and attendance, suggesting that they are looking for firm beliefs by which to live?
Yeah, well, remember, the evangelicals are also Protestants, and they are part of a much larger family of and even, I suppose you could call some Catholics evangelical Catholics. There are many who do. I when I look at this phenomenon, what I find is people who are looking for some kind of community experience, some kind of direct experience of God, a spiritual family or fellowship. They're not really that interested in the doctrinal formulations. Even in evangelical churches are moving very much away from strict doctrinal definitions into a much more experiential and communitarian way of worshiping and living. And I think that's what's drawing people.
Harvey Cox, he recently retired as the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard University, where he taught for 44 years. His new book is titled The Future of Faith. Stay with us. Harvey Cox, if you would, tell us about your own religious journey.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a small evangelical Baptist church in a small town in Pennsylvania, a town called Malvern. And I'm old enough so that when in those days, when I was growing up, we had a town of 1,500. I think we had 11 churches in the town. Every conceivable variety and flavor was represented. And there wasn't a whole lot else to do. There were no movies and
everything,
no television.
Everything was sort of centered around the church.
The picnics, the youth groups, the choirs, everything. Yeah. And we visited each other in the churches. I got very curious about why there were these different, why were there Methodists and Catholics and Episcopalians and Lutherans and Baptists and so on. Very early on, started reading about it and found it quite fascinating. And I guess I've always been somebody interested in the big questions, life and death and destiny and this and that. I never remember really being seriously interested in anything else except religion, theology. I discovered when I was in high school that there were not only the Baptists and the Catholics, there were also in the world, there were Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus. And that sort of enlarged and sort of complicated the picture. So when I went to college, I took some work in history and in philosophy and comparative religion and went on from there. And I've really been teaching in that field ever since.
It's interesting. You describe yourself as a practicing Christian, but not always a believing one.
Yeah, and I think that's an honest self-description that many Christians would have. I mean, certainly what I believe now as a Christian is different than what I believed when I was 10 or when I was 25 or 55. And I don't believe, you see, that the creedal side of Christianity is the most important side. When I was a kid in this church, Baptist church, it was following Jesus. That was what it meant to be a Christian, really, to follow Jesus. That's what I said when I was baptized. That was pretty difficult to do. But still, it was the way one lived one's life rather than a bunch of creedal affirmations. In fact, as you may know, I mean, Baptists don't have any creeds, as don't Congregationalists and many others. So I never even heard about those things until I got on later. I think we've been through a period in which the creedal element has been enormously overemphasized, and we're moving into a period now in which the practical and experiential and community element is coming to the fore.
What is the evidence of that?
One of the major evidences that I can think of is that the fastest growing branch of Christianity is the Pentecostal charismatic branch. Now think of it. A little over 2 billion Christians in the world. 1 billion are Catholics. The other billion now are divided sort of half and half between what we call mainline Christians and this very fast growing Pentecostal movement, mainly outside of the United States and Europe. But that's where the growth of Christianity is taking place. Now, that is a movement which is focused on the direct experience of God, the experience of the Spirit, even a kind of ecstatic experience, if you will, sometimes healing. But these are people who dance in the aisles and sort of move their bodies and so on. It's very experiential. And only very secondary are the doctrinal elements in it. That's where the growth is.
But look at the growth at the same time of Muslims and their beliefs throughout the world.
Well, yeah, there again, though, but Muslims around the world are divided into a whole range of different branches. And the one that's growing rapidly by the statistics that I've been able to discern, although not covered as much, is the Sufi expression. It's the fastest growing part of Islam in Iran, for example, especially among young people. Now, Sufi Islam is gentle, quiet, mystical, inward, experiential. It doesn't have that hard edge of the kind of jihadist, very small minority of Islam. And Islam is really not a creedal religion. There is only one God and Muhammad is his prophet, period. That's really not that fulsome a creed. And it's the way one lives one's life in obedience to God that's important for Islam. Again, it's mainly experiential and also strongly community-oriented.
How do you think that Christian fundamentalism grew so rapidly? Why did it grow so rapidly?
Well, I think it did grow rapidly and is now declining almost as rapidly, Christian fundamentalism. Last week, the Southern Baptists reported that for the first time in their history, in 2008, they actually declined in membership. Now, Southern Baptists have the most fundamentalists of anybody of any denomination. And the same is true of other fundamentalist movements. There's a transition in leadership there. Jerry Falwell is dead, and Pat Robertson and some of the other old-timers in that leadership are now sort of out of business. The real growth in evangelicalism now is in the megachurches. They're growing very rapidly with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 members. And the secret of the megachurches is that they put everybody into small groups. It isn't just this big stadium. Hmm. Everybody's in a study group, an action group, helping kids read in the inner city, food pantries and so on. They emphasize what they call ministries, getting out there and actually doing something to serve God and neighbor. And that's attracting lots of people. That is the fastest growing part of organizational part of Christianity in the United States, and now increasingly in other parts of the world. The biggest single Christian congregation in the whole world is the Yoido Full Gospel Church in Seoul, Korea. 800,000 people
wow.
in that church in one congregation.
Wow.
It's a gigantic stadium like thing. But again, they're all sorted out into these action and ministry groups. So you have both the experience of the big group and also the experience of being part of a small face-to-face group.
So what does that do to the overall notion of God as representative of what our belief system is?
Well, one of the grave errors that religions have made over the years and continue to make, I'm afraid, is identifying my beliefs about God with who God is. The two are not the same. And I think as we mature in any religious faith, Muslim, Buddhist, Catholic, Protestant, we recognize that our beliefs about or opinions or theories about God only scratch the surface. God is much larger and to some extent unknowable, a mystery. And we cope with this mystery in various ways. And as we begin to recognize that our way, important as it is to us, is one among others, we reach a stage of maturity. And we desperately need to get to that stage,
by the way. Do you see that happening?
I think it's happening. I think it's happening, yeah. The recognition of the porous boundaries between different denominations and churches and religions, which used to be seen as virtually impassable. All the borrowing that's going on. I mean, think of all the Christian churches where they have yoga in the basement.
Of course.
Or they introduce elements of Buddhist meditation and synagogues where they have Buddhist meditation. There's an awful lot of borrowing back and forth that's going on there.
And you feel that that's helpful to our growth of understanding, if that's what we're striving for.
Oh, yes. Not only useful. I think it's really urgent that we do that and not think of the others as somebody has to be either converted or killed. Someone said that one of the worst things about religion is some people are willing to die for their faith and other people are willing to kill for it. And I think we're coming to a stage where recognizing this plurality of views about God is becoming part of the consciousness of the different religions. Very much so in Islam, by the way. I've been to a lot of Islam-Christian dialogues in the last 2 or 3 years. There's a recognition there. There always has been in Buddhism, in Judaism. It's coming now in Christianity. And I think it's very, very vital.
Where does that leave the Bible?
Well, the Bible is our book for those of us who find ourselves in the Christian fold or in the Jewish fold, at least a large part of the Bible. And we also recognize that there's the Bhagavad Gita, there's the Quran, other takes on this way one relates to the ultimate truth that we call God. But that doesn't diminish the importance of the Bible. The Bible nurtures our understanding of who we are, even who we are with reference to other faiths. You know, if you read the Bible very carefully, you'll recognize that seeing other ways of knowing God and accepting them is not foreign to the Bible. They brought into the Bible things from the surrounding religious environment a lot. When David took over Jerusalem, he allowed the priests who were celebrating a previous culture to continue. Jerusalem was a religiously pluralist city for a long time. Now, we forget that the Bible itself is a religiously pluralistic document. and was written with reference to other kinds of religious traditions, including the Hellenistic religious tradition. And we've only imposed on it a certain kind of exclusivity, which really isn't part of it.
But when those individuals who oppose, for example, homosexuality in the priesthood point to passages in the Bible which talk about the sinfulness of a man lying with a man, what happens there? How does a broader interpretation of the Bible come in and affect change?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, this kind of battle of proof texting goes on. I quote mine, you quote yours, and I sort of add them up on a scale. It's not the way to use the Bible. I mean, the Bible is there, a vast collection of different books written at different times for different purposes. And what you have to ask, of course, is those particular passages that are often singled out, what was going on in the culture to which that was addressed at the time? For example, with the kind of homosexual behavior that's condemned, it was men making illegitimate use of young boys. That's really what they were out to stop. It doesn't in any way suggest that consensual relationships between adults, that's not what they were talking about.
But it has become, in essence, a political document.
Oh, it certainly has.
And it always was.
It always was a political document, and from very early on, and very often misused as a political document, sometimes rightly used. I mean, you can think of the magnificent use, for example, that Martin Luther King made of the prophets, the Old Testament prophets of justice, and the Exodus, his last talk in Memphis, I've seen the promised land. I mean, the resonance of biblical themes can be used for justice as well as for injustice.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Ralph, who's in Parma, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Good morning to all. Very interesting subject. And for me, I've chosen to go my own path. I do believe in Jesus, the man, in those things that he said. And if you think about it, Jesus spent his whole time preaching against organized religion and that you are to get out and help other people. The church is out here, not in there. And then a big church was formed in there. So I always go back to what his idea was, to get out and help other human beings. So to interact and help your fellow man when you can, with as much as you can, however you can.
Ralph, I think you've got a pretty good idea there. And, you know, it's embarrassing to a lot of organized religion, especially the elites that lead organized religions, that Jesus was very severe on organized religion at his time. Let's face it, he really was, as was the Buddha, by the way.
Give me an example of how Jesus, for example, was so harshly opposed to organized religion at the time.
Yeah, well, the kind of language he used against the scribes and the Pharisees and so on, who were the really kind of legalists of the time. He was pretty unsparing in his criticism there, and would talk about how important it was to make peace with your neighbor before you went to offer your sacrifice at the temple and all of that. Now, one warning I'd have for Ralph is if you want to follow Jesus in doing good in the world, you're probably going to do more good if you cooperate with other people. We're not going to get rid of organization entirely or ways of cooperating with each other and doing that sort of thing. And many churches are doing that. Lots and lots of churches are doing that. So I would encourage you not to simply make this a solo flight.
And to work with others to see where help is needed.
Yeah, with other like-minded people, sure.
Absolutely. All right, let's look at one of these emails. Here's one from Ravi in Washington, D.C., who says, what does globalization do for the notion of proselytizing, which seems a core component of Christianity and Islam? Are we seeing an increase in the use of new media to spread the message, or an increase in resistance to proselytizing as new media is used to challenge dogma?
Yeah, that's a very, very thoughtful question. I think what globalization does, of course, is to bring us face to face in an unavoidable way with the variety of different religious perspectives. There used to be people way there across the ocean. You sent missionaries or this and that. Now here they are, right in our neighborhoods. There are mosques, there are pagodas, there are temples. We meet them, and the kids are in our high schools. So that makes it very hard to think about proselytizing as the one way to approach these folks.
Harvey Cox, he recently retired after 44 years as professor of divinity at Harvard University. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Karen Armstrong joins us to talk about The Case for God. In her new book, she says that religion is a practical discipline that teaches us to discover new capacities of the mind and heart. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back, and here's an email for my guest, Harvey Cox, whose new book is The Future of Faith. This is from Jean in Ann Arbor. Please ask Professor Cox about the Christian values of ministers, such as the one in Arizona, who wishes that, quote, God would break the teeth of Barack Obama in his mouth. What kind of spiritual leader could say something so inflammatory? Jean goes on to say, I find such a statement to be not only irresponsible, but I would hold such people culpable should anything happen to the president or other elected leaders.
Yeah, that's too bad that even among people who should be spiritual leaders and helping people to move into compassion and understanding and would say things like that and wish things like that would happen. The sad news is that throughout the history of religion, to say nothing of politics and other things, there have been people like this. I mean, we can't disguise the fact that there have been that religion often encourages compassion and community and benevolence, but it also generates hatred and xenophobia. It's the atomic energy of the human spirit, and it can be directed in different ways. But one would hope that a person who has responsibility for directing that energy would direct it in a positive way, and that certainly isn't. Now, I would think that culpability is part of that scene too.
Is it true that more people have been killed in the name of Christianity than have died in wars?
Well, they're fairly grisly statistics to sort of add up, but I don't think that's true. When you think of the immense losses just in World War II, the Russians lost somewhere between 15 and 20 million, maybe even more, soldiers and civilians. World War I took enormous toll. I don't think that's true, more people have been killed. And, unfortunately, a lot of people were killed in the last century by anti-religious forces. And I don't want to generate any fulminations against them, but think of all the people in the in Soviet Russia who were persecuted and killed, in fact, because they were religious. So it's an ugly fact that religion and anti-religion and irreligion have been at each other's throats. And one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is to soften that kind of antagonism.
But is it wishful thinking on your part, or is it based on the reality that we may be coming to a new place in our thinking?
I say it is based on reality. And I've been traveling in Asia, visiting Christian congregations who are interacting with Buddhist and Hindu congregations there. I've been in Europe, South Africa, South America. This is the trend that I see, is this openness to cooperation with neighbors of other faiths, not seeing those boundaries as so severe and strict, working more together. And I also see a sense among people that everybody needs to get on board of this because of the danger in a nuclear-armed world of something flaming out of control.
All right, to Melrose, Florida, and to Sarah. Sarah, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question sort of goes right along the line of this, and I certainly hope that you're right, sir. What about the fundamentalist evangelical Christians that believe so strongly in Revelation that they feel that to promote world peace is actually to work against God and Christ, because it means that Christ can't come again and have this big war? And how does one address that?
Yeah, you're talking about what I call the Armageddon mentality, that we really have to kind of push for some great cosmic catastrophe so that Christ can come again. And all I can say is that having studied now for many, many, many years the Bible in Old and New Testament, I think the Armageddon mentality represents a gross misreading, a patching together of various verses in the Bible.
For example?
Well, I'm thinking about the Left Behind novels, for example, that project that we're at the end time and that there'll be this cosmic battle there between the forces of good and evil, and Christ will intervene this time not as the gentle teacher but as the warrior on the white horse. And end it all that way. I just don't think how you get that out of a careful reading of the Old Testament prophets and of the Book of Revelation and the Gospels, unless you excerpt and torture certain verses and paste them together with others to make this really flimsy case. I just don't think it can be made. But it's, in an odd way, it's sort of comforting to some people. That's what worries me. We're all headed downhill for disaster anyway, so you can't do anything. Why bother? It generates a kind of a why bother syndrome. And I think we have to bother. And I'm very grateful for those religious groups, Jewish and Muslim and Christian, that are working valiantly for peace in the Middle East rather than just standing inside and waiting for Armageddon.
And now to Bert, who's out in San Antonio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I have your coffee cup that you signed for me many years ago.
I'm so glad.
But I want to ask Dr. Cox why some of the Christian leaders that we hear so much of that he has referred to have not taken the time to point out the hypocrisy of our congressional leaders jumping on our president, and especially the ones, start quoting them, who are afraid to give health care to undocumented aliens. We have a, I think if he could go back to the Gospel of Matthew, the 31st chapter, and as much as you have done it unto the least of these, you have done it unto me. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear him comment on this.
Yeah. You know, I think if I lived in a community that had some undocumented people, including children, I'd sure want those children to be vaccinated. I'd want them to have health care for my own protection, let alone for what is the clear mandate of the Gospel of Matthew, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, the poor, the sick, the marginated, the people in prison, and all the rest. I don't know what the political possibilities of health care for undocumented people are realistic or not. I think the moral imperative is clear to me, that the Bible says treat the stranger in your land the way you treat yourself, because you were once a stranger in the land of Israel. It could be nothing clearer than that, that we have a responsibility for the stranger, and that includes that stranger's health care.
All right, to CeeLo, North Carolina, to Matt. Good morning to you, sir. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to commend the guest that you have on. I appreciate his, if I can use this word, enlightened view of Christianity. However, I get a little bit irritated with the kind of self-congratulatory tone of some modern Christians now who are backing away from some of the dogma and kind of seeing the folly of belief in some of the creeds of a unproven and unprovable kind of narrative. And as they step away from that and feel good about themselves and hope that other people feel good about them, to take a step even further and live a moral life and an ethical life without buying into this dogma or this narrative, and still live the teachings of Christ and Buddha and all of the great prophets without being a member of a religious organization or belief in God necessarily, somehow that's crazy talk. And how it's not even part of the dialogue in religious conversation these days, nor will it be anytime soon, because it's just completely out of the realm of our discussion at the moment. And I really don't understand why, as Christians become more and more like realists, they're somehow supposed to be congratulated for that, and I do applaud them because it's certainly a more rational way of dealing with our fellow man. But the hundreds of thousands and millions of people who live moral and ethical lives and take care of people and love each other without God or without religion somehow are crazy people.
I'm not sure I get the full import of your question, but let me respond to it this way. Something I said earlier in the show, which is the first 300 years of Christianity, the original movement, there weren't any creeds. There weren't any hierarchies. People were coming together, banding together in small congregations to follow Jesus, to continue his project, precisely, of feeding the poor and helping the needy, and doing it in a cooperative way. And only later did hierarchies and creeds come in. Furthermore, most of the Christians in the world, if you add them up, most of the Christians do not belong to denominations that have a creedal or hierarchical structure, or at least half of them don't. So it's possible to live the Christian life without hierarchies and creeds. It's being proven every day. And I think more and more people are going to find that's the way to do it. And as they do, they'll see that they do need each other. Again, I don't think this is something you can just go off and do on your own. We need each other. This is a very large task we have, peacemaking in the world, for example, which Jesus clearly told us to be peacemakers. You can't do that individually. You have to do that with other people who will cooperate with you.
But the Bible does say where two or three are gathered.
Where two or three, yeah. That's a start.
That's a start.
And it's not individualism. It's not individual piety. It is, after all, the original Christianity was a new community, was a new way of gathering people together across the boundaries that existed at the time between Jews and Gentiles and slaves and free and all the rest. It was a new form of inclusive form of community and not just a new way to be an individual.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Lafayette, Indiana. Hi there, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was born and raised a Christian, mostly Protestant and all Protestant sects, but I have recently sort of shifted away from that the fundamentalist beliefs that I was taught because, and I would like Dr. Cox's take on this, but I find it almost embarrassing that the American political system has sort of divided itself into these two groups, and that the Republicans are really umbrellaing themselves underneath this whole Christian movement. This is, you know, this is the way God intended everything to be, and like the previous caller had mentioned regarding healthcare. My question is, how would Christ have responded to these right wing Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh types claiming that they're somehow better because they're more Christian than, say, I am, who have begun to kind of question my beliefs and have kind of leaned more mainstream.
Julie, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
How old are you?
I am in my early 30s.
Okay. Just wanted to know. Go ahead, Harvey.
Well, Julie, let me point out that the transition that you're going through, which you described so eloquently, is precisely the transition that millions and millions of people are going through. That is seeing a much larger and more inclusive and in some ways a more thrilling view of who God is, what Jesus expects of us, how to be a Christian. You're part of a very, very large trend. It's exactly that trend that I try to talk about in my book. And I'm glad you've provided even more evidence that it's really going on in Indiana and various other places in the world. Now, as far as what Jesus might have said about Rush Limbaugh, that's a wonderful question. I don't think he would have been too gentle on Rush Limbaugh, but I won't put words in the mouth of Jesus. He does pretty well. And he was especially against people that he found to be pretentious in their own righteousness. That was one of the things he really put the finger on.
Give us an example of where he did that.
Well, the parable of the sinner in the temple, the Pharisee and the sinner in the temple, where the Pharisee pounds on his own chest and says, how proud I am that I'm a righteous man. And the sinner said, I'm just a poor sinner. And Jesus said, he's the one who's justified in God's presence and not the prideful, righteous Pharisee.
I'd like to end this conversation. I really would prefer not to end the conversation, but I'd like to end it with your thoughts about Mother Teresa and her feelings about God.
Isn't it wonderful that Mother Teresa, whom millions of people rightly admire as really a kind of almost an incarnation of what it means to be a Christian in the world, taking care of the most hopeless, sick, dying people, in her letters that came out a year or so ago, says she went through long periods in which she doubted the existence of God, whether she was really a Christian and all of that. But she kept doing it. She kept doing what Jesus expects her to
do. Because?
Because that was what kept her going. That was her vision of life. That was who she was supposed to be. And she did it. And some people said, oh, maybe she was just being hypocritical or really a fake. She wasn't. I mean, she was living with precisely the kinds of ups and downs at the belief level that most people have who are religious people, but continuing to do the kinds of things we're expected to do.
Harvey Cox, his new book is titled The Future of Faith. He has just retired after 44 years as professor of theological studies and divinity at the Harvard University. Such a pleasure to talk with you.
Great to be here, Diane.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.